Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Bonnie Kay in the Straight Wives Talk Show. And this is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexity of marriages between straight women to gay men. Each week, my co-hostess Misty Hall and I discuss issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or bisexual man. So, good evening, Misty. How are you?
Good evening, Bonnie. I'm doing great. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. I'm very excited that we have our very special guest tonight.
We do.
And without further ado, we'll be introducing her. And her name is Juliet Jeske. And Juliet, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate your being here. You've been getting a lot of attention on the internet lately, and also through your blog and through the Huffington Post. And one of our support group members had, you know, turned me on to your blog when you wrote about your gay husband.
Yep.
And I was just so impressed with, you know, the column itself, and that's why I'm so excited that you can be with us. And if anybody has any questions that they would like to ask Juliet, you can always call in, and our call-in number at area code 646-716-4893. I'll repeat it one more time, area code 646-716-4893. Or you can email me at bonk@aol.com if you'd rather not call in and just send in a comment. So, Juliet, tell us a little bit first about you and how you came into the field of entertainment, because you're a clown.
Yeah, I've been performing since I was a very young kid, and I don't even really know anymore how or why. I was very shy and withdrawn when I was little, and then strangely got into performance, and then it was like a theater person and did singing and have toured as a singer and worked as an actress, and then I got kind of disillusioned with live theater and then sort of morphed into a stand-up comic, which is what I identify myself now as. But my ex-husband was a clown in that he was a circus clown and a theater clown, and he performs all over the world in Europe, and he's very, very accomplished, and he sort of sucked me into clowning. That's kind of how I pay my rent. So I still work as a clown, even though I'm trying to kind of get away from it because it's so intertwined with what he does, and and it was just sort of a weird transition. I never thought in a million years that I would turn into a clown or a stand-up. They've both been kind of accidental, and as has the writing. The writing came about because my therapist told me to write because she was Italian, and she was going to be gone, you know, when an Italian therapist goes on vacation, it's 6 weeks, so she was going back to Italy, so she didn't say, make it into a blog and make it public, and I just did, and then it sort of little by little snowballed, and then people said, send your stuff to Huffington, so I did, and then that exploded, and it's just been completely crazy, so.
But crazy good, right?
Crazy good, and it just goes to show you that quote of the John Lennon quote, life is what happens when you're busy making other plans, it's like, I'm the embodiment of that right now. And then, the worst thing that happened to me is turning out to be, in a weird way, the best thing that happened to me, which is really bizarre. I never would have thought 2 years ago. I mean, I left Joel about 2.5 years ago, that indirectly the divorce would be, like, the best thing that's ever happened to me. I never would have thought that. So, I mean, it just goes to show you.
It does. You just never know what you can do.
Yeah.
You never know how you can take your ex-husband's and turn it into a career, I suppose.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
We have another woman who's part of our support group, a very dear friend of mine. I mentioned that to you, Tracy Rosenberg. And she's also, you know, doing a lot of stand-up comedy in New York at Caroline's and Stand Up New York. And she developed a whole routine on gay husband comedy. So
I know, it's like one of my friends, some of my current friends will give me grief about, oh, you talk about the gay clown ex-husband, and I said, come on, it writes itself. I mean, not only gay, but clown. I mean, seriously, like, people get a kick out of it because it's shocking, but at the same time, like all of us, you know, I constantly hear, oh, I know somebody who went through that too, I know a man who went through that, I know a woman who went through that. It's far more common a problem than people think. And I am a member of the Straight Spouse Support Network in New York. I go to the monthly meetings when I can. I've missed the past couple, but and it's just amazing the variety of situations that people end up in. You know, they've been married 20 years, 30 years, you know, 2 years, and just how we all feel so similar, yet, you know, it's like this weird bond that goes through the group because we all went through that shared experience. It's just like you've got to be, it's just, you know, horrific.
Right. And
so,
I think that
yeah.
unless you've been through this experience, it's really hard to have other people understand it. And that's not to say they can't intellectually understand it or they can't feel sympathetic, but they just don't understand the deep emotional cutting that this particular situation brings, more so than other marriages do.
I think so, and they'll even say stuff that really people have no clue. I mean, they say stupid stuff to – people tend to say really stupid things to people who've been divorced without thinking about it. But I think the worst comments that I've gotten is when people say, oh, that was an easy divorce. I'm like, oh, my God. Or they
right,
say
exactly.
– they go, oh, well,
did
at least he didn't cheat on you.
Well, how about did they ask you if he was gay when he married you?
Yeah, I get that all the time, too. People think that I knew somehow, and of course they didn't. They'll say, well, didn't you guys have an arrangement? I'm like, no. And then, like, well, how – and, then I like, it's so funny because it's become, like, a screening mechanism for people, too, because when somebody says something really insensitive or really rude, I'm just like, well, okay. Like, I was online, and this guy, you know, because I try to date online a little bit, and I haven't had much success, but a guy made a comment. I don't normally bring it up right away, but he was talking about something else, and it's a long story. He was asking about something, and it led to, because so much of my writing's about the divorce, it sort of got opened up, and his comment was just one sentence, and I just went, we're not going to go out. Good luck to you. And the comment was, I just don't understand how someone wouldn't know their spouse was gay. And I was like, would you say that to a woman whose husband was a serial cheater? Like, I didn't know. How could you not know he was cheating on you? You know, like, you
well,
know,
I think
of course.
The problem is that, you know, people don't understand gay. And even in this day and age, we're in 2011, moving quickly into 2012. It certainly has come a long way since when I was, you know, married back in 1978. And, of course, you know, that was over 30 years ago. But still in all, people still don't understand how this happens. And, you know, the funny thing is that we don't understand how it happens. And that's because we don't understand gay going into it either. You know, we're brought up to understand that gay means someone who likes someone of the same sex. Why would we think someone's gay because they're pursuing us? Why would they think, you know, why would we think they're gay because we have sexual relations with them? You know, it's not that they don't want to perform with us. They fall in love with us. They want to marry us, have families with us. And that's because they themselves many times can't come to terms with the fact that they're gay. And I always tell men, if it takes you so long to figure it out, how do you think that, you know, it's gonna, we should just instantly accept it and understand it? You know, it takes them years to really understand themselves, and it takes us a long time to understand it, too. But people don't understand that unless they're going through it. They think we should have known it automatically. Or, you know, as we were talking about before the show went on, we were saying that when people make comments, well, are you sure he's gay? Or was he gay when you married him? Or did you make him gay? You know, implying like that, that there was something that we did to control this.
Yeah. They don't get it. It's really bad. It's like it's very insulting, and they don't realize how insulting it is. And they think, oh well, I'm just asking a totally normal question, and it's like my ex-husband's brother was also gay or is also gay, and it's part of what put Joel deeper in the closet because. He was kind of, he saw how his brother came out and he saw how his parents reacted to it. And he realized, oh, that's awful. And I don't want to be that. And he would say things when we were married that were very telling. He'd say, my brother's miserable because he's gay. And I'd stop him and say, no, your brother's miserable because your brother's miserable. It has nothing to do with the fact that he's gay. And Joel kept harping on that. And I said, you really have to stop that mentality. Because I know plenty of gay men, they're well-adjusted and happy and have been in long-term relationships. And, you know, it's like anything else. And he was just, you know, he'd harp on that and harp on that. And I think he somehow blames some of his brother's misery on homosexuality. I think he blamed all of it on homosexuality, which isn't fair, you know. And really showed a profound, in a weird way, self-hate towards himself, because I think he knew. Because he said in therapy he knew since he was 8, which just blew me away, because I'm like, oh, you could have told the lady you married. Because, you know, I confronted him several times before I found, like, hard evidence. And he, because it was kind of getting obvious, and he would get very angry, and, you know, I was a horrible human being for even, you know, for even broaching the subject. It was just, you know, I said, it got to the point in the last, like, year of the marriage that I said, if I sat any third party down and said, this is what's going on in my marriage, they'd say your husband's gay. But I just didn't want to see it, because I just, you know, I was in love with him. He was my entire life. I had really, really dedicated myself to him, and my identity was so wrapped up in him and what he did, and, you know, because he was the big shot, and he's Mr. Personality. He enters the room and everybody goes, oh, you know, is kind of how he is. You know, kind of we talk about this in the support group, definitely had some narcissistic tendencies. I think it's like a very common problem. Very common, because who else thinks, oh, I'll suck another person into my lie? And they don't think about, like, you know, what I'm going through or what they're doing to my life, you know.
Well, I say it's not only narcissistic, but it's also sociopathic in many cases, because these guys, you know, start, you know, compartmentalizing their whole lives, and they don't realize the harm that it's doing to the person who they married in good faith and promised to love and take care of, cherish, and, you know, do all the things that you're supposed to be doing as a husband while they're out there, you know, cheating on you, betraying you, lying to you, bringing home sexually transmitted diseases to you. And to me, did you find that your husband was lying about stuff?
Oh, there was lie upon lie upon lie. I mean, there's just like, he was better. I mean, I've read a lot of the straight spouse books, and he was a lot better than some of the worst examples. Like, he claims he never cheated on me. I don't know if I believe that, but especially with one particular person at the end of our marriage, I'm not that stupid. Like, it was pretty obvious. But I think for most of it, he was so repressed that he wasn't really acting on much of it. He was just kind of falling into his own reality in his head, because a lot of his stuff was on the computer, and I didn't find evidence of, like, chat rooms and emails. I found evidence of, like, just, it was almost like his own little world. But he told me he went to therapist when he didn't. He told me he had erectile dysfunction when he didn't obviously have that. You know, and I mean, he was better. I mean, he was really much better than, so, I mean, I've read about some of these guys who, you know, lie upon lie upon lie, and then they, you know, actively attack the wife when she finally leaves. They just set out to destroy her life, and I did not go through that at all. I mean, I went through my ex-husband, to his credit, and we had a couple touches of him getting nasty with me very, very briefly, but for the most part, he was guilt-ridden. He, you know, kept trying to make things better for me, trying to support me as best as he could. It took a while. I mean, it took a long time. My therapist even said, like, if I wasn't angry at him, then something was seriously wrong with me. Like, she's like, you have every right to be angry, and you should be angry. You just can't stay angry. But if you try to say, oh, it's fine, you know, 3 months after, you're going to lose your mind, because you're just bottling it up, and it's going to come out later. And now I was raging mad, which is funny, because when we were married, we had a very, other than the weird secrets that he kept, and when he was emotionally pulling away from me, we had a very, very calm marriage. And that's part of the reason why I stayed in it, because I came home to peace and calm, and a distant but you know, fairly mellow husband. And it was great to have that rather than, you know, my friends who have these tumultuous relationships where everybody's fighting and screaming and yelling. And I didn't have that at all. So that's part of the reason why I stuck around as long as I did. But
now, did you both come from the same kind of religious upbringing?
No. The funny thing is, everybody asks that. It's a very common question with Joel.
Mm-hmm.
We think he was Catholic. He was Lutheran. And
mm-hmm.
Lutheran's kind of Catholic light. And his particular family wasn't overly religious.
Mm-hmm.
I would say of the, and I've kept his last name, I would say of the Jeskys, their predominant thing that I think probably caused his homosexuality to become more and more closeted was they were very much about keeping up appearances and looking very perfect and having, you know, they lived in a community that was very conservative and pretty and you know, I always called it Pleasantville because it was a kind of an upper middle class suburb of Chicago, and the houses were gorgeous and the lawns were gorgeous and almost everyone was white and everybody was conservative and everybody was, you know, pretty well off. And then there were these big McMansions that start popping up. You know, people would buy two lots to build a bigger, huge home. And that's kind of, it was Glen Ellyn, Illinois, and that's kind of where he was from. So he just, and they all knew, like, very different from where I grew up. They all sort of knew what all their kids were doing. Like his mother's generation knew every little bit of gossip about everybody's kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I came from like a hick suburb of Missouri, of St. Louis, where, you know, it was like, it's not like a, Joel was more from like a town. Where I'm from was like a suburb. Nobody cares. Nobody
mm-hmm.
kept in contact. You know, my mother doesn't get around with a bunch of other women in the neighborhood and talk about their kids. It's just not what she does.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never even heard of that. Like we just scattered. It's just very different. And I think so. Trying to keep up that appearance, Joel like was very much an overachiever. He's very accomplished at what he did, and he just wanted to maintain that kind of perfect identity. And he'd had multiple girlfriends before me, long term girlfriends. I mean, it from the outside there was no. It was very hard to tell, you know, the stuff he was hiding from me. Very, very difficult. It wasn't until I cracked that egg and the constant started spilling out all over the place that I went, oh, my God, it all makes sense now. And then I had a couple of his ex-girlfriends on their own, this is weird,
mm-hmm.
contact me on Facebook to tell me things. I didn't look for them. I didn't want to find out. I didn't care. And they're dumping this information on me. And I thought, oh, why are you doing this? It's over. I don't need more pieces of the puzzle. It's over. I just want to be rid. I want to be gone. I want to be free. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I found out there was just layer upon layer upon layer upon layer of lies. So, yeah.
How old were you both when you met?
I was 27. He was 32. And we got married when I was 29 and he was 34.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Yeah. Have you had much experience dating prior to him?
Yeah. I had dated, I was very much a serial monogamist in that I was very much like I would date somebody I wasn't like a dater. I'd have a boyfriend and then have another boyfriend. And
mm-hmm.
so, but I dated somebody in college for 3.5 years and that was, you know, relatively normal. And the guy I dated before him was, I think, about 6 months. The guy
mm-hmm.
before him was like a year. So it was just odd. I mean, Joel just has this personality that's very charismatic and very charming. And we clicked immediately and he's sort of like physically my type. And it seemed to make so much sense at the time. And all my friends who met him loved him. My family loved him. Everybody thought he was the perfect guy for me.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of haunts me now because I don't trust my judgment at all with men.
I think that's very normal, and I think that we all go through that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not so much the, you know, meeting somebody, it's all the self-doubt that if we made this mistake once before, how do we
mm-hmm.
know we're not going to make it again?
Mm-hmm.
And then I think we all go through the for the first couple of years following a marriage, we all think that everybody we meet is gay.
Yeah.
Everyone
yeah.
that we date, you know, that we're so overly
yeah.
cautious because it happened once and we were fooled. And I think it's really normal to think about, well, this is going to happen to me again. How did it happen to me the first time? And it will happen
yeah.
again. And every man looks
yeah.
gay, and every man
yeah.
seems gay. And I think that that's a really common feeling that all of us have. So don't worry about that. That will pass.
Yeah, I practically give them questionnaires. It's pretty funny. It's like, have you done this with a guy? Have you done this with a guy? Like, it's like I grill them because I'm like, I don't want to be through this again. I don't want to go through this again. But I mean, I don't. I'm so bad that I don't even like. My trust is so messed up that I don't really believe anything they say. So I even if I like them, I'm still looking stuff up about them online. I'm still like, you know, looking for clues. It's like after what I went through, and it's not just so much looking for clues if they're gay. I'm looking for clues if they're cheating. Looking for clues if they're you know, keeping other stuff from me because it just. When you
yeah,
go through a betrayal like that, you're never right again. You know, you're always like, I don't know. It takes
it's
so
funny,
much longer.
I wrote a book a few years ago. It was called Man Readers, A Woman's Guide to Dysfunctional Men. And at that point, you know, I was working with, you know, four of my friends, and we were trying to pull this group together to be able to do man reading, as I called it. And we did some really great jobs for people where, you know, they would send us a man and we could analyze them, like, within the hour of everything good and bad. And the group just never took it. The group never took off, and I took the book off the market, so I'm revising. It'll be out in a couple months. But, you know, as I'm going through it all again and updating it, you know, certainly mentioning all the kinds of bizarre men that are out there, and there's millions of them, with all kinds of sexual problems besides gay. And it's really scary
oh, yeah.
some of them. And all kinds of emotional problems and mental problems, you know, so that eliminates, like, about two-thirds of all men. But I do have a section on there on how to be your own man reader and all the things you need to do before you get involved again. But I think that, you know, people can hear all the advice and all the different ways to check, but I think that eventually, you know, you start thinking with your heart and with your hormones instead of with your head. And that's what the problem really is. That, you know,
yeah.
we fall in love with someone and we're willing to overlook certain things. So even if we're more cautious, you know, and even though we know now certain things that would not be acceptable, you know, it takes a lot to stand up and say, this is what I won't accept in a relationship. And I think these relationships really destroy us in many ways. You know, they destroy the feelings of trust that we had in ourselves, not just in the men,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Trusting our own opinions, you know, because they really do take away a lot from who you are. Like you said, you spend a lot of your time you know, trying to revolve your life around your husband. Then you kind of
yeah.
take on the identity of being his wife and
yeah.
he is your life, and you kind of lose who you are because, I don't know, you were married for 9 years, Juliet, and you weren't, you know, really young when you got married.
Yeah, we were together for 9. I was married for 7. So
okay.
it's not a big deal. But
no, but you were together for 9 years.
Yeah.
So maybe you understand this feeling that I'm talking about when I say that you always know something's off. But
mm-hmm.
you don't exactly know what it is. And so
mm-hmm.
you just keep trying harder and harder to make him happy. You know, when
yeah.
you feel that emotional distancing, you're thinking it must be, you don't externalize it, you internalize it because they're not being honest with you. You know, they're
yeah.
not telling you why they're emotionally, you know, void with you now. So you're feeling like there must be something you're doing wrong. And why aren't
yeah,
you making him happy?
Mm-hmm. And he would run around, the irony is he would run around, and this really got really painful in the last couple of years. He'd run around and say, oh, he'd always rave about me. Oh, my beautiful wife, my gorgeous wife, my charming and talented wife. And he would go on and on and on about me when he was out with his friends or
because mm-hmm.
we work with a lot of the same people. And then he'd come home and just go on the computer and shut down. And they
exactly.
would, I would hear, yeah, and I'd hear from people going, oh, he's so in love with you. He just talks about you nonstop. And I go, really? Because...
Mm-hmm.
And I would confront him with that. I'd say, why am I dealing with these two realities? And he would turn it around and say, I was the one being distant.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
and they're very
go,
good at doing that emotional manipulation. They're really excellent
at
turning it back on you. You know,
yeah.
no matter what the problem is, it's you're the one creating it.
Yeah, yeah. And it really got bad in the last year because I... realized that we were having serious problems, and I just begged for him to get therapy and to go to a doctor, and that's when he started lying about that. And I said, look, you really, I really need to, we need to get this together. I can't do this anymore. And I said, because he was pestering me for a child, yet the marriage was completely, at that point, 100% celibate. So he's pressuring me for a child, and I said, well, you know, we have to be doing something in order to have a child, which we're not doing, and it's certainly not my fault. And when I put my foot down and said, you know what, I don't want one, because we don't make enough money, and your job's too in crazy, and blah, 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 that's when he really turned on me and started blaming me for everything, because he had been very good about not doing that, and then he was like, well, you're the one killing my sex drive, and it's you, it's you, it's you. And that was sort of the turning point. And then when I found, like, the hard evidence, I was like, well, this explains a lot. And then I was like, and then the irony is, as soon as I left him, the first thing I wanted to do was have a kid and meet somebody new, which it hasn't happened yet, and it may not, whatever. But mm-hmm. I've kind of had to come to terms with that, which I think has been the most painful thing, but the whole experience. Like, I stopped going to my therapist because every single session was, I want to have a baby and I don't know if I can do it. And she would be like, well, you know, she didn't really know what to tell me, because what can you tell somebody in that situation? Because I can't afford to have one of my own. And she was like, you know, you're still young, you just go out and meet somebody. I'm like, I'm not meeting anybody. And then I would just start crying. And I'm like, well, this isn't really helping me. And it would be every single week. That's what was happening. It was like a broken mm-hmm. record. And I said, mm-hmm. I'm going to stop going to therapy because this isn't helping anymore. But I've had to, on my own, I've just had to come to terms with my reality may be that it will never happen, and that's okay. And that's just it, you know. Maybe I wasn't meant to have kids, and my life will work out okay and be wonderful without them. You know, I've just had to accept that, because I don't want to rush into a relationship with somebody I don't really shouldn't be in a relationship with just to have kids. And I think it'd be very, in my financial situation, I think it'd be very irresponsible to have one of my own. I don't pull it in. I don't pull enough income in. And
I think that's really responsible of you to say that, because so many people just say, well, I'll trust it to fate and whatever happens, happens.
I can't imagine.
Not realizing how much, you know, your time in life goes into having a child, raising one, and being a parent is so difficult. I mean, I'm not trying to discourage anyone, but, you know, it's just such a big responsibility. And it does cost money to have children and to raise them right and to give them the things that you want to give a child. So some people don't think about it. They just do it. But I think it's really admirable that you're thinking about it before you're jumping into it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I come from a blue-collar background, so I don't mm-hmm. come from any amount of money. And I know how hard it was for my parents, so I just go, you know, I have a niece, and that's about it. I have one niece. My mother mm-hmm. had four children, and it's such a Catholic torture for my poor mother. She had four children and only has one grandchild, and mm-hmm. will probably only have one grandchild, and she's so mad about that math. She's like, how did that end up working out? Like, how do I not have, like, 12 grandchildren? It's like, well, that's what happens, Mom. Sometimes you have one. Deal with it. So...
Right, you're happy with the one.
I know. I tell her all the time, you have one healthy grandchild who lives a mile away from you. Celebrate that, Mom.
That's right.
You know, I mean, it's like some people don't have that, Mom. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
So, listen, Juliet, do you think you could read the column for our listening audience?
Yeah, I will read it. It was called My Ex-Husband the Clown. So here we go. Okay. I remember telling my parents when I first met the man who is now my ex-husband. I started with a positive. He was college-educated, worked with a touring company of Chicago's acclaimed Second City, studied with the Cambridge Footlights in England, and had toured the world a few times over as a performer. Then I finally let the cat out of the bag. He's a clown. My parents were oddly accepting. I think they had grandchildren in mind, and half-clown grandchildren were better than no grandchildren. As far as clowns go, my ex was quite accomplished. He's been nominated for 2 Drama Desk Awards, performed with every major circus in the country, and has also performed extensively in Europe and Asia. I always say, he's kind of a big deal if you're a clown. But being married to a clown, even a semi-famous one, is not a barrel of fun. For starters, there are the other clowns, many of which were extremely snobby. The pecking order went something like this. Theater clowns. Well-trained, with college degrees or higher, the performances were not always comical, and sometimes they were only entertaining to other clowns, considered the most artistic. Circus clowns. Some join the circus straight out of high school. They have skills such as juggling, stilts, acrobatics, etc. Always funny, have a reputation for being rough around the edges. Birthday party clowns. Derided by theater and circus clowns. Yet some birthday party clowns make more money than any other type of clown. Hobby clowns. Amateurs who dream of one day becoming circus clowns. A few even follow circuses around like groupies. Gospel clowns. Clowns who view clowning as a calling rather than a job use clowning to proselytize. Many don't believe in getting paid. Rodeo clowns. Work with animals rather than people, in a category all their own. To the rest of the population, a clown is a clown. So a highly skilled theatrical clown like my ex is the same as a hobby clown named Sparkles. A man wearing a rainbow wig, scary makeup, a dirty costume, and plastic shoes who twists balloon animals in the park for tits. As a result of this common misconception about clowns, the clown world is full of rules and standards. In order to be a real clown, one had to study with Lecoq in France or Comédie de l'Arte. Clown College, which was run by Ringling Brothers, was shut down in 1997, so any circus clowns that came after that time were viewed as having lesser training. So imagine marrying a highly regarded member of the Red Nose Mafia. They weren't exactly the most welcoming group. And what made the situation worse was that my ex decided I should become his partner in crime. I thought that working as a clown might be better than a mostly out-of-work actress, so I took the plunge and attended a brief clown school in Manhattan. I liked the training, but found some of it to be completely inane. In one class, we were told to shout obscenities and throw tennis balls at each other. It was beyond useless. My ex and I made great clown partners, but for years. No matter how many gigs I booked, and no matter how many huge audiences I entertained, I never felt completely accepted. I often felt like the Yoko Ono of clowning. I was even accused of influencing my husband not to work with certain people, or to only work with me. It was all nonsense. I never had any aspirations of running away with a circus or becoming a famous clown. By joining my spouse in his passion, I was trying to make my marriage stronger, as this art form was so important to him. But I made the mistake many spouses make and put his dreams before my own. By subjugating my own desires and needs for his, I was making our lives too interdependent. His happiness became more important than my own, and I would ultimately pay the price for this. When the marriage fell apart, I not only lost my partner, but my ability to earn an income. Most of the clowns cut me off immediately. I went from working all the time to not working at all. I tried to get traditional employment, but in this competitive job market, I had no luck. I have joked that being a clown for 9 years is the same as working in the sex industry. It is a stain that won't wash off. And thanks to the internet, I can't hide my past. So I stopped trying to go straight, and I went right back to clowning. I had to build up my own clients and relationships with new entertainment agents, and I'm slowly pulling myself up. Now that it is all over, I'm the one with the strange occupation trying to explain to people how I got myself into this line of work. It's never easy to say to people, especially potential dates, I'm a clown. My ex-husband got me into it. A shocked expression usually flashes over their faces, as if I'm about to start some type of joke. Sadly, I am not.
Well, that was quite beautiful. And that's what I got into being the clown. And about your blog about divorced after being straight spouse for 2 years later.
Yeah.
After being a straight spouse.
Yeah.
You happen to have that one handy?
Oh, I'd have to look it up really quick. Let me look at my blog really quick. I have my blog.
September
13th. Yeah, it's all good. I just have to look it up really quick because I moved out from an old blog. I was trying to date someone because it kind of felt like trying. It wasn't really dating. And it had fallen apart right before I wrote that, and I just sort of hit the wall. It was a guy who was more interested in emailing me than actually seeing me. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason why I put up with it for as long as I did was because it was safe. And I compared to, it was sort of like a fake relationship. And And I think that's why I got sucked in, because it was like, well, you know, I don't really see him. And I called the guy my fake boyfriend. I mean, he didn't know that, but
no, I
called that
to my friend.
I think
so vulnerable after these marriages, Juliet, that, you know, we, you know, I call it gay husband recovery is a period we all have to go through.
Yeah.
And I think it's like any other kind of recovery program, where I always tell women, although you feel mentally beaten down, sexually deprived, you know, self-esteem's down on the ground, you have to give yourself time to build yourself up before you run into another relationship, or you're going to make the same mistakes, you know, that you've been making all these years, that, you know, even if you weren't making them before your marriage, you started making them once you were in your marriage, because you're so vulnerable.
Yeah.
And it takes time. So I think a lot of us go into, you know, semi-kinds of safe relationships like you were in. You know, I think that's a very normal thing to do.
Because it was safe. So I found it. I got it. Okay, September 13th. Here we go. Yeah, it's called Divorced After Being a Straight Spouse for two Years Later. Okay, here we go. I still remember my wedding day vividly. Any day planned and fretted about for months is going to stick in your brain for a lifetime. Any day built up as the beginning of the rest of your life will burn into your psyche. In the same way, horrible trauma sears its pain and anguish deep in your bones. Try as you might, you can't shake the pain. It becomes a part of your very foundation. Few positive memories have the same effect. For whatever reason, our bodies, hearts, and minds tend to cling to the negative memories, such as being humiliated in front of your class, not being able to get your jeans off in time due to a broken zipper and wetting yourself at Girl Scout camp, seeing my father lash out at me at yet another blinding rage, losing a job or role for unknown reasons, having a voice teacher tell me I would never be a singer, seeing the face of a lover suddenly go cold and distant, having no one show up at my 13th birthday party, and on and on and on. The traumas and disappointments get inside of you like a bad virus you can't shake, but the good memories fade quickly. The memories replaced instead by just vague emotion. Instead of specific images, they blur into shifting colors through a window. Instead of the detailed, sharp, piercing prongs of negative memories, happy thoughts become reduced to feelings. I can't remember holding my cat for the first time, hugging a friend I've never seen forever, the first kiss from a person I adore, winning a competition. They drift. They fade. Only warm, pretty shadows remain in their place. The memory of my wedding day is now traumatic, but still beautiful in my mind. So like the crazy, nuanced event that has become, it is now a hybrid of negative, crystal-clear clarity and blurred, fuzzy happiness. The one image that keeps coming back is the walk down the aisle. I used to have a post-traumatic stress disorder-style flashbacks of the very event. I'd be sitting on the train or reading a book, and for no reason it would flash in my brain as clear as it was actually happening. The cathedral, with his family on one side and mine on the other, the organ music, with all of these faces turned towards me. It was so overwhelming. All I could do was get through the ritual, was to focus on my soon-to-be husband and move closer and closer to him and the rest of my life. I knew that if I turned to look at people on either side, I would start crying, and I didn't want to cry on my wedding day, so I kept focusing on the task at hand, and that was getting down the aisle without shedding a tear. My husband was now my new family. The scars and damage from my old one were over, and I had chosen this man to start over and help me wipe away the darkness of the pain in the past. Since my divorce, I've had a recurring nightmare of being outside of my body, trying to run up to myself in the moments while screaming, "Don't do it, don't do it, don't do it." The sound of my screams echoing through the great hall of marble, but no one looks up, no one even flinches, and I still just keep moving forward. Nothing I can do can stop me. It's like looking at ghosts reenacting the same scene in a play over and over. I hate it when people say, "Well, at least your husband was just gay. It could have been a lot worse." Or anything to the effect that I have somehow had it easier than a typical divorced person. I guess in some ways I have, in that the end was so absolute. There's no reason to second-guess why I was leaving him. No amount of couples counseling, no amount of therapy or listening skills that would have made anything better. No horrible act of betrayal that I could regret for ending everything. But on the downside, I felt cheated. I got cheated at a chance at a normal marriage with a man of the same sexual orientation who loved me like a man is meant to love a woman, in mind, heart, and body. I was cheated of the chance of having children and being a mother. I know now I might still have time left, but dating at age 38 is difficult, as half the eligible men already have children and don't want more. In my current state, I couldn't afford to raise a child on my own, as I can barely take care of myself. There are times in the subway or the park that even the sight of a young mother with her child will send me spiraling. Suddenly, tears come from nowhere, and I can't make them stop. Why is she so lucky to have the one thing that I will never get to experience? I'm constantly told that I shouldn't give up hope, and that I should be able to sustain a relationship, but I haven't been able to sustain a relationship for any length of time, and every other man who I find compatible is already a father, doesn't want more children. I had to end therapy because literally every single session was the same conflict, the same fear, the same resentment over probably losing the chance, to be a parent. When my therapist suggested I go back on medication and then tried to get me to justify what I consider a fairly innate human desire to procreate, I couldn't take it anymore and ceased the sessions. I was cheated of the dream that everyone has when they get married, that despite the obstacles in life and arguments, fights and petty annoyances, I no longer have a partner for life. I was cheated on the intimacy of an adult human sexual relationship. It seemed normal at first, but it quickly became dysfunctional. But because I loved my husband, I stuck it out. And now I beat myself up for not leaving sooner. So over 2 years have passed, but I'm still not right. I'm still not healed, and I don't know if I ever will be. I'm suspicious of every man I meet. I trust no one. It is so debilitating that I actually stick around in relationships that aren't fully formed, that aren't as scary, that aren't as real. I'm scared to have a real one. But my shattered life has in some ways made me stronger, like a piece of metal cracked and then welded back together, or a bone broken and then reset. I am no longer the same shape. My insides, my skeleton is not the same, and I don't react to pain in the same way. I am far more empathetic to another person's pain, especially anyone divorced. I feel deeply for them, and I cut them a lot of slack for self-destructive behavior or lashing out at themselves or others. I know they're in a ton of pain and that most of their actions are not directed at me or anyone, but instead directed at the emptiness inside of them. I have also learned that I have to heal myself before allowing anyone else in. I no longer have the husband to unload my emotional baggage on, and my friends get tired when I repeatedly do it to them. So I'm now forced to deal with it on my own, with just my broken heart and damaged soul to mend myself. These things have definitely made me a better friend and a better person, but the lack of trust and emotional scars have made me more skittish and more apprehensive about letting anyone new in. I have become damaged goods, complete with certain memories playing repeatedly in my mind. Hopefully, I will one day be able to replace the Photoshop negative ones with more blurry, happy thoughts. But until then, I try to ride the nightmare of the memory of walking my new life to my new life of fraud, deception, and loss. 2 years ago, I was pushed off a cliff and survived. Now I just need to figure out how to pick up the pieces and start climbing again.
That is just such a beautiful piece, Julia. Thank you so much for sharing it with our listeners.
Thanks. Yeah, it's been a while since I wrote that. here's the irony of that piece. When I wrote it, my sister thought it was too personal and said, you've got to take that down. It's too personal, and your blog's getting too personal and it's getting too out of control, and she was worried about me. And because it was actually published before September. It was published in August. I just moved it from another blog. And then Labor Day weekend, I wrote a piece. It doesn't have anything to do with straight spouse, but it was called Dating After Divorce in a City of Sluts. And it was just me kvetching about trying to date New York.
Mm-hmm.
And the piece completely exploded all over the internet. And I did international press for it. I, 7,000 likes on Facebook. It was passed around all over the place. I had hundreds of emails, hundreds of Twitter followers from it. And my sister called me up a few days later and said, okay, I was wrong. Drop everything else you're doing. Do nothing but write. That was really funny. And she was like, don't write. Because I said, Jill, I can't get a real job to save my life at this point anyway. So, if people who are, the job market's so bad. People with, amazing qualifications can't get work. No,
mm-hmm.
The goofball that I am is not going to get a job. So I just said, well, I just got to keep doing what I'm doing and, hopefully something will pay off. And I had no idea it would be the writing and no idea that the writing would get me attention or that anybody would care. I started the blog because, like I said, my therapist told me to write, and it helped. I always feel like it exercises demons.
Well, not only that, but you really are helping people. I mean, the woman who sent it to me was a member, long-term member of my support group. She's been there for a couple of years. And she was just so impressed with your writing. And, you know, she said, you have to read this. And, you know, I'm not going to, I'll be honest, it took me about a week before, you know, I actually got to it. But when I read it, I was so moved by this. And there's just one thing you wrote in here that I just felt really hits it on the head. I mean, it's all beautiful. But I love when you say here, it says, there is no reason to second guess why I was leaving my husband. No amount of couples counseling, no amount of therapy or listening skills that would have made anything better. No horrible act of betrayal that I would regret for ending everything. Mm-hmm. But on the downside, I felt cheated. I got cheated at the chance of a normal marriage with a man of the same sexual orientation who loved me like a man is meant to love a woman in mind, heart, and body. And I just think it's just so beautiful the way you put that. And Misty, are you there?
Yes, yeah. I'm here.
Maybe you could discuss a little bit about the feelings that, you know, of having when you're in your late 30s and, you know, this comes down on you and then now you want to have children, because I think that that's something that you and I have discussed.
Absolutely. I feel your pain. You know, when I first got married, I thought, well, you know, because I got married quite young. I think I was, oh dear, it's a lifetime ago now. 19, so very young.
Wow.
Age. Oh yeah, very dumb, and was even dumb enough to stay more, well, about 10 years, and husband, same name as yours, and I won't go any further than that, but anyway, ex-husband, that is. So it got to the point, as your marriage was falling apart, as mine was falling apart, my ex was begging for children. I'm like, no, same as you. You know, you actually mm-hmm. have to have sex to have children. He was blaming it on me. He had made me an appointment to see a fertility specialist because I was not getting pregnant. But anyway, bottom line,
I
have to have sex or a must meet egg. You know, that's the way it happens in the normal world. So anyway, and it got to the point, and I thought, oh, my God, this marriage is crazy. I can barely survive it myself. I can't bring a child into it. I'm not going to do it. So I put my foot down. No, we're not having children. And then it was a very abusive marriage. And I was I guess I was about 30 when I got divorced, somewhere around in there. And very fertile, you know, could be. But unfortunately, at that point in time, I decided I don't want children. You know, I don't want children. I'm okay with it. And I was coming out of a marriage very broken. I had taken some time to heal, but when you come out of a gay, straight marriage, you're very broken mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually. I mean, I was drained. I was an empty carcass walking around, dead on the inside. I didn't know who I was. So, you know, I need to take that time to rediscover myself. And then I was working at this attorney's office in they're like family, and I met, you know, since they are family, I knew their children, and they were quite small then, and their children just sort of grew on me. Well, you know, by the time I hit 35, I don't know what kicked in. Something kicked in. I was like, oh, my God, I've got to have children. And, you know, and I hate to tell you, I'm 40. I still do not have children, and I have no prospect of a mate. But, you know, I'm hopeful. I am hopeful that I will have children. And it's not too late, but as you know, when you face that clock, I mean, my clock is not ticking. Mine is shouting profanity at me. You better hurry. You know, it's not ticking. It's shouting profanity. But, you know, it is hard because 10 years out, I'm healed. But when you start talking to someone new, there are those little residual things that come up. There are the trust things that come up. And you know, you have to revisit all that. I'm very, very, cannot add enough, very cautious in there when I approach a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So it is. It does alter you. It alters you in a way that I won't say, I mean, I think I'm healed from it, and it, you know, I think women do heal from it, but it does, I will be very honest, it alters you in a way that that I will remain the same in many ways. Even though I'm healed, I will approach things with more caution. I will be more conservative, and I won't step into a relationship with the innocence that I did many, many years ago, you know, just to see where it would go, you know. But it is. That is part of the grief that I've experienced, especially since turning 40. And I'm a few years ahead of you. Turning 40, it doesn't get any better. And it's like that mamahood thing has kicked in to overdrive.
I know.
And it's strong.
Is it recent with you, Misty? I mean, this isn't something you've been feeling for a long time.
Well, it started about 35, but it wasn't strong. When I turned 40, I don't know what happened. I mean, it was building up. When I turned 40, it got crazy strong. And it's something that I think about a lot. And I think everyone says, oh, well, you know, you should try adoption. You know, I think adoption is great, but that's something I will visit down the road, but I would also like to have part my child. You know, I would like to experience the whole thing with a partner. And, you know, I have actually looked at going to sperm bank, sperm donor. But, you know, I'm very conservative. Every time I think and get ready to go forward to do that, I think, wow, you know, I would like to have a child that had a mother and a father, you know. Even though I am a marriage and family therapist, half marriage is in a divorce anyway, you know. It's pushing
I know.
But I would
you
like
don't
to start out with that, you know. I
it
would
takes
like
a lot of courage to become a single parent without a partner. I'm not saying that doesn't happen in a marriage. You know, my marriage broke up. My children were, you know, 3 years old and 2 months, 3 months
mm-hmm.
old, or 2 years old, mm-hmm. and the other one was 3 months old. So I was kind of like a single parent for many, many years. But
mm-hmm.
I don't think I would have gone into it, you know, on my own. Now, that does not,
that's
just that I didn't have the strength to do it. So, I mean, I'm certainly not discouraging anyone. But I think it
I'm
takes a lot of thought, and I think it takes... You know, like Juliet was saying, you really have to be in a financial responsibility to raise a child.
It's huge. Yes. It's huge.
I just,
especially
and I don't know if I have the guts. Yeah, and having the guts to do it by myself, I don't know if I want to do that, you know?
Juliet, I had to move out of New York when I was pregnant because I knew, and I was married, but I knew that there was no way that I could give a quality of life to a child with the expenses, you know, so I moved back here to Philadelphia where I live. Because here you could get a really nice place for, you know, what you couldn't even get a little single studio apartment there for.
Yeah.
You know, it's really hard in New York to raise a child on a single income, and especially if you don't have a continual single income. It's hard to live yourself.
Mm-hmm. That's why I'm getting to the point now that it's kind of funny. Like, I just have to, it's like a weird reality that I have to accept. I kind of joke that, like, I had, you know, like every kid, you have a bunch of dreams, and a lot of them didn't come true, or a lot of them moved in a totally different direction than I'd mm-hmm. anticipated. But the one that has kind of kept me going is that I always wanted to live in New York, and
mm-hmm.
I absolutely adore New York. So I just think, well, God, if I gave that up, I would completely fall apart. So
mm-hmm.
it's like, in theory, I know I could, you know, go back to Missouri, go to I can't imagine doing this, get a sperm donor, live with family members for a while until I, you know, got up on my feet again. But I don't know if that would be worth it, because I think my spirit would be crushed by that. And then how great of a parent would I be if I, you know, I can't imagine going through that. You know, I just keep hoping, well, maybe I'll meet somebody, or, like,
and it can happen, Juliet. You know, you can't
give
up on love. You know, I gave up on it for 11 years after my marriage was over, you know, and I had little children, and I had to raise them, and I had to go to
mm-hmm.
school, because, you know, I had no education at that point. And I put my life, personal life, on hold, and guess what? I was really happy, because, you know, it didn't bother me, because I had to build myself again. But, you know, in years to come, you know, I met someone who was wonderful with me for, you know, nearly 18 years.
Wow.
And taught me, you know, what love was about and that life can start over. And, you know, I have so many women who have happily ever after again stories. You know, I usually print them all in my newsletters every month. And, you know, I love to print them because I like to give people, you
mm-hmm.
know, knowledge that this does happen, that there are wonderful men out there. And, you know, don't give up on looking for your soulmate. And don't, you know, just say, well, I can accept it. You know, maybe on one level you can accept it, but don't give up, because he's out there looking for you somewhere. You just
haven't found him yet. I know. My joke is right now that I keep saying my boyfriend is my book, because the comedy is when I was writing a dating book, because that's what people kept telling me to write about, dating after divorce or dating in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I was building that up, and I kind of had a plan in my head. Then my literary agent kind of discovered me and said, no, you're writing a memoir.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, I'm writing a memoir. So I'm like, so that's, it was like literally like the record skipped and went, okay, because I think he made a great point where he said, I think your story is weird enough that if you don't tell it first, people will go, what? The not only the gay husband, but the clown husband. And he said, he thought that there's a great, because I was never obsessed with clowning, I was sort of always along for the ride, I have a unique perspective into that universe. And then the gay thing is even weirder. So he's like, I think it's enough, a compelling enough story that we can tell it first and then worry about something else down the line. And I think he's right, because I was getting feedback from a lot of other people about that. And he's a very successful agent. He's had 2 books get on the New York Times bestseller list, so I will do whatever he tells me to do.
Absolutely.
I'm not like, so I keep joking, my boyfriend is my book. So, because I'm like, I took myself off OkCupid, I took myself off Match. I said, I have to focus on this, because this could be what pulls me out of doing birthday parties for a living, and might be, books are very rough, as you know, you've been published. It's not necessarily, it's a difficult road, but I have to say, well, I think in my writing there's more hope for me being able to afford to be able to raise a child down the road. I don't think
mm-hmm.
there's any hope being a clown or even a stand-up comedian. It's a very, very tough market to be stand-up.
Very
so
tough.
I just go, yeah, I still love doing it, but it's like, well, if my writing could get me out of this, then I'm going to focus on that because, yeah, we only have so much time. It's not like, I'm 55 years old and then goes, oh, I'm going to adopt a kid. I could
mm-hmm.
do that. I don't know if that would be the wisest thing to do either, but, it's that sort of like what I'm, yeah. So right now I was like, for a guy to meet me, it would be like lightning striking. It would be.
That's all right. It can happen where you least expect it. And that's why
it
happens
yeah.
all the time to people. They're in the right place at the right moment. Boom, it happens. So, keep the book as your boyfriend for the moment, but don't give up on the real thing. That's the important
boyfriend's
thing.
My book.
Absolutely.
And boyfriend, the book boyfriend probably won't disappoint you as much as other boyfriends will.
True.
It will not.
And you have more control over it.
So true.
On how long that relationship lasts. But I truly am a believer in soulmates, and I really do believe everyone has a soulmate out there looking for them. It's just a matter of being able to find them. So don't give up on your soulmate either. But Julia, can you let people know how they can reach your blog?
Yeah, it's all connected on my website, which is my name. So it's really easy. It's Juliet, like Romeo and Juliet. And then my last name is spelled Jeske. It's Jeske, and it's J-E-S-K-E. So if you Google Juliet Jeske, you'll find my website, which has a link to my blog. And then you can even go on Huffington Post and Google Juliet Jeske and find all my stuff in Huffington. I'm so obnoxious. I have a website, a blog, and a YouTube channel, all named for me.
I think that's wonderful. That's really
great.
And
I'm like,
okay,
I don't bother
with
a fake name. It's all
no, and if it's okay with you, I'd love to mention you in our upcoming newsletter coming out.
Oh, yeah,
next
that'd be
week.
Great. It'd be great.
And everybody who gets that, we have about 7,000 women on our mailing list.
Great.
They can get a link to your, blog and to your website.
That's
and
great.
We can see you on YouTube also, because I didn't check that out yet.
Yeah, my YouTube's more of my goofy comedy, and some of it is very political. I used to do political satire for Huffington in the comedy section. Only reason why I stopped doing that is when I got divorced, I kind of didn't care about politics. So I do care about politics, but it just took a back burner. It's like my personal life got so crazy, it took over everything. I think that's what happens to a lot of people. I was like, who's president?
No, Julia, I want to ask you like a more ridiculous question. Here it is. In your experience of spending all these years now working with the clowns, which I never knew there was this kind of pecking order until you informed us.
Same. Yeah.
But do you think there's a large number of gay clowns?
I think there's probably more gay clowns than the regular population, yeah. both men and women. They wouldn't say that. They would probably come down on me and say, oh, horrible, blah, blah, blah. But, yeah. And there's a couple other people that I will not mention any specifics, but there's a couple people that are, I think, also closet cases. There was one who used to accuse my ex of being a closet case all the time. And so when Joel finally came out, this individual doesn't say anything to me. He just, because he, I mean, don't.
No, I always say it takes one
to
know one.
What?
Well, I say it takes one to know one.
Yeah, he hasn't said anything to me. So, and I think he knows why.
But I would think that, you know, I would think that, like with any other entertainment industry, you know, that this would certainly, there would be a higher number proportionally of gay, you know, performers.
Yeah, I think there, I think just the performing arts in general.
Exactly.
A slightly higher than probably the average population. I don't know why. It's just, I couldn't tell you, but, you know,
you
why there's so many.
I was going to ask you, do you find that clowns are funnier than most people, or is that more of an act?
Depends on the clown. Some are hilarious, and some are incredibly not funny. Some take the art form so seriously that when they do the performance, they don't want laughs. It's very odd. It's a very odd art form. And then some of them are just skill-based in that they can juggle and they can do all these crazy circus skills, but they're just not funny people. And they couldn't be funny if you put a gun to their head. They're not funny. So it's a mixed bag. I find comedians to be much funnier, but, you know, comedians are a disaster usually too. Male, especially male comedians, usually are very depressed, which is so ironic. But, yeah, it's a, you know, it's like anything else. It's like you would think they're a barrel of fun, and not so much.
Yeah, I was really curious because I really don't know anybody who's in the clowning industry. And, you know, it's always interesting to me, you know, that people are willing to get on stage and be someone who they're not, or to try to entertain. Or, you know, I just never knew until, you know, reading your work that there was all this difference in, you know, clowns. It was really informative.
Yeah, there's a lot more to that. That was a really difficult piece to write because I could have written so much more. And that's what I'm working on now, is I'm trying to write the so much more. And I'm like, oh, there's so much here. I'm sort of joking, it's turning into the Mommy Dearest of clowning books a little bit. Although, not that I'm out for revenge on anybody, but I'm not. I don't really care. But it is sort of a, because I'm not in love with the art form, I'm not all like romanticizing it. It is kind of funny when I talk about it because I'm like, wow, these people are crazy. Rather than, aren't clowns beautiful and magical? I'm like, some of them are.
I guess that's the illusion that we all like to think about, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and some people hate clowns, and they're terrified of clowns, and there are so many layers, so many layers. So it's a weird little universe that I honestly never thought I would ever be involved in, and it's what happened, and I was like, okay, and now I'm like, glad that I'm trying to get away from it because I just, it's too much of my ex and I'm like, wow, I don't care.
Do you have any contact with him at this point in time?
Yeah, we're good friends, I would consider, but it's a weird relationship. And I even told him, we had a conversation today about the book, and I said, basically, when X, Y, and Z will not be included in the book, so don't worry. Like, I'm not going to get specific about his sexual stuff because I really don't want to write about it, and I don't think people really want to read about it.
Right.
I just finished a book that my agent worked on, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, by the woman who played Nellie Olson, and that was a bestseller, and a New York Times bestseller, and she dealt with incest in her book. And what I liked about how she wrote it is she just sort of mentioned it. She didn't get that specific, didn't get, like, detailed. And I was thankful she didn't because I don't, you know, it was such a horrific thing to read that you're like, oh, my God, that you didn't want to know specifics. And it's sort of what I intend to do with Joel. Like, I wouldn't write specific stuff that I found or specific stuff that I just don't. Who wants to know that? I don't want to know that. That's not the type of book that I want to write. You know, because I was incredibly thankful that Allison did not give me more details. I was like, oh, that's so horrible, you know, and then she just talked about other things, and then how she dealt with it later and confronted her brother, all that stuff. But it was, I thought, very, very good of her not to get graphic and nasty, because I don't know if I would have finished the book, to be honest. Cause
I think there's only so much that we can, you know, many of us can humanly accept, you know, or visually accept in our minds.
Yeah, so I think Joel was reassured that I said, don't worry, that's not gonna show up in the book. And I said, names will be changed,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'm not going to go after anybody specifically. I'm going to probably do the writer trick of taking two people and putting them into one. You know,
mm-hmm.
that's very, very normal, just to make the story go, you know, more smoothly, because it's not really supposed to be about these specific individuals anyway. It's supposed to be about the journey and about the community and all that fun stuff. Not, you know, like, if you don't know the name of somebody, you can make it up. It's, no one's going to come after you and go, oh. You know, it's very normal in that kind of style of writing to do that, so.
Julie, I just want to ask you this. You know, you were married to a gay man for a number of years, or with, you know, a couple of years before you got married. Were you, and you were a girl from Missouri, a conservative Catholic,
yeah.
Missouri, were you
yeah.
open towards gay people prior to your marriage?
Oh, yeah. My best friend in high school was gay. He didn't know he was gay, but he kind of came out later. And I'd gone to Pride parades when I was a teenager. So it was even weirder that this happened. And, I mean, it's just proof it can happen to anybody, because I was incredibly open-minded about it. And you know, and I would say this, too, because Joel, this is, sounds strange, but like, I know that there's like certain stereotypes of acting gay, and I know that that's sort of a stupid thing to say, because there's so many ways people act that are gay. You know, it's not like they all mince around and talk with a lisp and, you know, do the weak wrist. I mean,
mm-hmm.
hello, we wouldn't have ended up marrying them. Hello. So Joel was incredibly, you know, quote unquote, straight acting. So
mm-hmm.
it was even more. And nobody believed him when he first came out. Nobody even believed him. They thought I was somehow making this up. Some people still don't really accept it. They still don't.
Mm-hmm.
They still think that he's just went through a phase, and that I can't make that up. Some people still haven't accepted that he's gay. I'm
mm-hmm.
like, he's out and proud. He is out and proud. Go ask him. He'll say he's gay. So I don't understand that. But
mm-hmm.
yeah.
I guess people don't want to believe it, and you know.
No, they.
But,
yeah.
But I don't think it's unusual. See, I think this is what you may not understand. I mean, you're prime picking for a gay man to be a wife because of the fact that you are so understanding and accepting. And I think that there's a prototype of a woman that gay men look to marry, and that's certainly one of them. So, yeah, I think it was a very natural match. You know,
yeah.
even if they don't consciously believe they're gay, because I think that a lot of these men go into these marriages really hoping against hope that loving a woman enough will take those feelings away. I mean, they're not looking to hurt you. They really do love you. You know, they're hoping that loving you enough will take those feelings away, but they don't go away. And
mm-hmm.
but they're always hoping that at least the woman will understand that those feelings don't go away. Maybe she can live with it or accept it. So it's either a conscious or subconscious move on their part to find women who are accepting, caring, and women who are, you know, able to perhaps deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think it was any mistake that he found you.
Yeah, I know. It's just one of those things of like, man, I always, if I could invent a time machine, I could go back, you know. I was just like, oh, my God. But I can't, so
well,
I did.
You can think about wonderful times ahead, and, you know, that's what you do have to look forward to.
Well,
you
yeah,
know,
and I think.
You'll become a successful writer, and you'll meet all kinds of new people.
Yeah, that would be, if I could pull myself out of this through the writing, which would be a complete accident, because, again, like, it's not any, you know, I mean, I did well in writing classes in college and stuff, and I was a tutor for remedial kids in college, because I went to a school that was like an inner-city college. It was not really inner-city college, but anyway, they took a lot of kids from inner-city school. It was an art school. So they took a lot of people who didn't have the traditionally the best education. But no one ever was like, oh, you're a writer when I was young. Nobody. That's why it's like,
mm-hmm.
how did this happen? I mean, it's just one of the, I mean, my creative writing teachers liked me, but nobody ever went nuts. And now they're going nuts. And I'm like, this is absurd. Like, I'm a performer. I don't know what I'm doing. But it's like when I meet somebody who says they fell into acting, I want to choke them because I'm like, how did that happen? Like, I just fell into acting. I never had any training. I just start working and making gads of money. And I'm like, what? Because I know so many people who've, like, killed themselves and never get anywhere. So I'm like, whatever. Just proof
yeah,
that life
well,
is...
you have a talent. And you know, you just have, like I say, you just... Not everybody can say that. I think it's a wonderful thing. It's a blessing to have that kind of talent. So
yeah,
people may work harder than you to get there. They just don't have the talent that you have.
But it just shows you how just life has got so much like just weird chaos in it, and you just don't know.
You have to look at
life
like an adventure. I think that's the way I try to view it. You know, for every bad thing, there's something good that comes out of it. You know, I try to take all the lemons in my life and turn them around. And
yep.
So. You know, once again, I look at life every day as a new adventure. You never know what to expect. You wake up in the morning and go in a totally different direction.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you believe in, you know, finding a goal and finding a purpose and look how many people you're helping, even though that may not have been your, you know, intention to start with.
It wasn't at all. It wasn't. And it was total accident. When I would get emails from total strangers saying, oh, this was exactly what I went through or, you know, you really spoke to me, I was floored. I just went, how is this happening? But that's why I love the internet because it is democracy. You don't have to be from a great school. You don't have to be from money. You don't have to be connected. You can put yourself out there and by hook or crook and luck, you can get noticed and not just for writing, for everything. So I love the internet. I just can't say enough good things about it because if you can go from being an auto mechanic's daughter to, you know, getting this kind of crazy accolades and living in New York and all that stuff is, like, you know, it's unheard of because, you know, the last guy I tried to date had this, and I love saying tried, had this very highfalutin job and knew all these famous people and blah, 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 blah. But, you know, he wasn't from a blue-collar background. He was from at least an upper-middle-class background. So it helps. You know, when you're from very, very poor people, it is not easy to even go to college. So, you know, that's why I just think, and I encourage anybody, like when I get people who are very, very vicious towards me, my critics online, because I will get people who just attack me, I say, well, take that passion, and instead of putting it on my comment section, which no one's going to read, start your own blog. You know, I don't know anybody. I'm not connected. I'm not dating someone important. Start your own blog. See what happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't use this energy to attack me because it's not going to work. I don't care, you know, because I get venom from every direction, so I don't worry about it. Everybody, if you put your opinion out there, people will throw it back. So I don't take it personally. I don't worry about it. I just go, whatever. If it all came in the same direction, then I might go, well, maybe they have a point because I've gotten 10 comments and they're all saying the same thing. But that's not. I get same comments, and they say 10
comments you get seem to be very encouraging to you to keep writing.
Yeah, on my blog on Huffington, I've gotten pure venom, but it's okay. I don't worry about it. I don't worry about it.
No,
I mean.
In fact, another column you wrote that I really love before we go, I just wanted to mention was the one you wrote about being Catholic.
Yeah, why I'm no longer Catholic. Yeah.
That really moved me.
Yeah, thank you. I don't have a problem if someone once is a Catholic and loves their faith, and I have many friends that are Catholic, many relatives that are Catholic. Most of my relatives are Catholic. I hit the wall for many, many reasons, and I write about it in the blog. And I would love to see an anthology, actually, of a bunch of different writers writing about loss of faith. Because we have so much in this country about, oh, I found God and it's so wonderful. And that's great if somebody found God and it's wonderful for them. But I think the difference is when you're a child, you don't have a choice. And whatever your parents' religion is kind of shoved down your throat. And there comes a point as an adult that you say, you know what, no. And I think that's the difference. I think I reached that point where I said, we're done. And I consider myself agnostic because I just say, well, I don't know what's out there. But I don't have a problem with religious people. I view people for who they are, the content of their character. You know, like some religious people are wonderful people, some religious people are horrible people, just like some atheists are wonderful and some atheists are horrible. You just have to look at a person for who they are, not what affectation they're putting on, like, oh, but I'm a Baptist and I go to church every Sunday. Well, are you a decent human being? I don't know. That doesn't necessarily – I was brought up to believe, yes, you are a decent human being. They're better than other people, and now I completely reject that idea. I say, well, I don't know that person. They could be wonderful. They could be horrible. So, yeah, I have a very weird relationship. My parents could not have been more Catholic, and it didn't stick with pretty much any of their kids. So,
well, I like when you're saying in this column, you said, what I saw in my Catholic upbringing was an overwhelming belief in blind faith and authority. My parents didn't question, and we were taught not to question. The priest was right and holy, and we were not to see him as a human being with frailties, but instead as a man who could perform a miracle each and every Sunday by turning ordinary bread and wine into spiritual body and blood of Christ.
Yeah.
I think that's why the church was able to cover up the child sex abuse for as long as it did. Parents of the victims would think nothing of leaving their children alone and unprotected with a celibate adult male. And children could not dare speak of such crimes that were done to them by holy men.
Mm-hmm.
And the saddest part for me of losing faith is that in my youth, I was a believer. I would pray to the Virgin nightly, as the images of a bloodied, half-naked Jesus always scared me. But the sweet face of Mary in her gilded blue robes and her arms outstretched while crushing a serpent beneath her feet calmed me. She was my hero, my sweet face in the evening to look up to and put my life's prayers and fears into her never-ending loving face. I would have dreams of her hovering over my bed with light pouring from her eyes, telling me everything was going to be okay and that I had nothing to fear. The fighting in my household would stop, the Russians wouldn't nuke us to oblivion, and that one day I'd be able to get out of that tiny little bedroom and sleep on a bed on which I couldn't feel springs through the mattresses. I was so proud at my first communion at age 7 or 8 when I held my beautiful, shiny statue of Mary that I picked out myself out of the Catholic supply. I mean, I just think the way you put your words are just so beautiful.
Oh, thanks.
On everything and about your disillusionment. But, you know, but with also with the compassion and the understanding, you know, very few people could intermingle all of that.
Well, that's,
you know,
the thing,
you worked it all in.
Yeah, I've met some very, very angry atheists, and I think it's kind of sad. They get very worked up, and they get very angry, and they really hate people of other faiths, and I want to stop them and say, you know, you sound just like the Baptist who's screaming about how much he hates godless atheists. Like, the hate has to stop, because it's like, we may not agree on the same, you know, religion, but if you paint people in that black and white, like, well, they're religious, so they're stupid. Oh, they're atheists, so they're cruel and vicious. It's like, no. Like, I understand where people get religious devotion, and I understand why it's important to them. I may not share the same belief, but I do. You know, it's a fuzzy
right,
area
exactly.
for me. But I definitely say, yeah, I definitely say, like, he, like a guy I was dating was railing about people trying to convert him and blah blah blah, and I said, they don't bother me, because I see why they're doing it. I politely tell them no, thank you, but they really think they're trying to help me. So
right.
I understand that, and I understand that they're coming from a good place.
That people can have that kind of faith. You know, I may not have it, but
yeah,
I always admire people who do have it.
What I think is sad is when people attack and they blanket statement and they say, well, you're a godless heathen, and you're going to burn in hell, and you're a horrible person. Well, okay, whatever.
Yeah, I don't like that either.
You know, it's the same as, you know, when they say that to me, it's the same as somebody saying, oh, you know, somebody's Baptist or somebody's Lutheran, they're an idiot, blah, 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 blah. Go, stop it. You know, like, that kind of talk, I don't think gets us anywhere, and I think if there
was a
church,
whole purpose of religion. It was,
religion
was about love. And no matter what people have turned it into, right. I mean, there is no purpose for that. But
you're
right, people are just crazy, and that blind faith is different than having faith.
And that's why I studied the Torah briefly. I found that to be very interesting, and the Jewish tradition to be very interesting, because they're not like our way or the highway. They're very much like, okay, whatever, you know, hey, whatever. And people would sit around and discuss the Torah, and nobody was right, nobody was wrong, and I just sat there shocked. like, what is going on here? Because it was so different than Catholicism. The rabbi's like, well, that's your opinion, and that's fine. And I'm like, what? So, I mean, it was, I don't think I'm going to convert to Judaism, but I did think it was an interesting thing to study and very misunderstood religion, I will say. So I thought that was interesting, but it was one of these things of, like, I don't know if any, you know, quote-unquote organized religion will ever stick on me, because when you're raised in that rigid, super strict, you can't help but become disillusioned, in my opinion, because they're going to let you down, because they're human and they make mistakes, and so many issues I don't want to get into, but, you know, because it'll spiral into another topic, but a lot of things that I just kind of, the sex scandal is what finally did it. When my mom was like, why don't you go to church anymore? And I said, Mom, have you read about that and how bad it was and how bad the cover-up was? And there was a pedophile in my parish, and there was a pedophile in the neighboring parish, and true, there was. We didn't find out until years later. And my mom's like, I understand. She didn't even try to fight. She just went, I get it, you know?
I know. It's tough to understand because I have a half-sister who's Catholic.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was raised in the Catholic Church, and I, you know, say to her all the time, I can't believe you're still giving them money. You know,
and
that money's not going to help people, it's going to help pedophile priests. And, you know, I have this conversation often about the pedophile priests because it really upsets me that, you know, the Catholic Church has handled this so badly when, people don't realize these were not priests who became pedophiles, these were pedophiles that became priests because it was the access for them to get to children. So it was, you know, an easy way to do it. And instead of just sticking their asses out of there and saying, you know, we have no place for anybody like this and we're going to prosecute you. And so they stayed firm and, you know, defended them and kept them there. So
yeah, and it's a shame because there are good priests out there and there are good people doing good work. And they just, the ones that were bad have ruined it for so many people and destroyed so many lives. So
even today in the front page of our Philadelphia Inquirer, there's a whole article there about the tough year that's going to be ahead for the Catholic Church. You know, the closing of schools, the prosecution of 37 more new priests that they found here this past year, you know, who were accused of sex crimes. You know, it's endless. And it's really, you know, the number of Catholic schools are closing. And, you know, it's a terrible, terrible mess that maybe could have been prevented if it was handled differently. I guess we'll never
know.
We can't change it.
And you
but
think about
I'm
all
so
this.
Glad, right, but I'm really glad that you write about it and your disillusionment. I just think you did it so beautifully.
Thank you.
So we're going to just say goodbye to you and
thank you so much,
Juliet. And when your book is being published, maybe you'll do us the honor of coming back again.
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding? I will do all media known demand.
And I really hope to get to meet you someday when I come into New York.
Thanks so much. Okay, thanks so much.
All right, sweetie, take care.
Thanks,
Bobby. Your book.
Uh-huh.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Well, wasn't she a delight?
Yeah, that was a very delightful guest, that's for sure. She's got a lot going on for herself.
She's a young lady who has a lot of good insight into things, and she's an excellent writer.
She is. Excellent.
And I think that she can really express her feelings and how she felt about going through that marriage and through the divorce. Without having to, you know, like she said, she didn't have to sit and talk about the details of what happens, but just the emotional impact that comes about from it. And I think that's really important to be able to do that because people need to know how we feel. And we need more people out there writing about what we go through so that people can understand it.
I agree.
So, Misty, any workshops coming up?
I've got the one coming up the Sunday before Christmas, which I think is the 18th. You've caught me off guard again. It will be at 2 p.m. on a 2 p.m. on a Sunday, and you know that's coming up. Wow, where is time going? I'm telling you, time does go by faster. I guess when you have time, it goes by faster. You know, when I was married, I can tell you, I was pretty miserable. I don't know if time went by this fast, and once. Time is just flying now. But anyway, I don't know where this year went to. It's unbelievable. So,
it's hard to believe that it's almost over. And are you starting to bake for the holiday?
Yes, I am. And I'm getting ready to bake someone some sugar cookies. But I'm not going to say who that someone is because
it should be a surprise.
Because
I'm announcing it in my next newsletter. Okay. And I'm requesting that people who are baking send me 6 cookies. So I'm going to see what kind of outreach people make back at me that I'm reaching out to them. I figured I'm trying to get something that's going to make me happy this holiday season because I'm not feeling all that happy. So
you
I thought
should.
If I can reach out and have people send me 6 cookies apiece, that should do it.
That'll do it. That'll work, right?
Because that's in your case. You can send me a couple dozen. That'll be fine.
Okay.
But anyway,
great
also, for any of our listeners who are listening, I'm going to be in New York on December 27th and getting together with a few of our women there. If you'd like to have dinner with me, please write to me
great.
At bonk@aol.com, and that's on Tuesday, December 27th. And also, I will be in Houston, Texas, coming up at the beginning of March. I'll be writing about that in the newsletter. So if you'd like to meet me in Houston, and also with Patsy Ray, who was on our show last week, she'll be there. And Wendy from our Wendy's List will be there, and some of our other wonderful Texas sisters. I know, I'm so excited to be able to meet Wendy and Patsy and some of our other women who we've already met. And it'll be a really great weekend. So if anyone's interested, you can read about it in the newsletter or write to me at bonk@aol.com. So, Misty, I want to wish you a wonderful week, and we'll look forward to talking to you next week. We will be off for Christmas Day week.
That's right. It's on a Sunday.
That's right. So you'll just have to listen to our past broadcast, but we'll try to make it a really good one next week to hold you over over the holidays, and we'll be giving you some tips on getting through the holidays again next week.
Absolutely.
All right, Misty, have a wonderful week, and I'll let you sign off first.
Good night, and love to all.
Love to all of you, and we'll be back again next Sunday night. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.